Hartglass, and you are listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me for another week where I get to talk for an hour about my favorite subject, food, and all the things that are related to the food that we eat, our planet Earth, our health, and animals. So today I want to talk about food and food choices and how they affect the health of people and the health of the planet. And I'm going to be doing that specifically with my new guest, Linda Rebell, who wrote a book called The Green Food Print. And let me tell you a little bit about her. She's a psychologist and environmental educator at Saybrook University in San Francisco, where she has been on the faculty since 1993. She helped create the Sustainability Program. A graduate of Wellesley College, she is a member of the American Society of Journalists and Authors, as well as many environmental organizations. At SaveNature.org, she is program director of Edible Adventures, which brings the message of earth-friendly food to classrooms around the Bay Area. And the Green Food Print, which we're going to be talking about today, draws from a variety of sources, books, government reports, scientific studies, newsletters and websites of environmental organizations, personal communications with numerous experts, newspapers including the New York Times, valuable in showcasing good news such as growing food on rooftops and keeping us up to date on unfolding stories such as ocean depletion. We're going to be hearing a lot more about this book from Linda. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, I'm very excited to be speaking to your listeners and really supporting the movement towards food that's healthy for person and planet.
Amen. So we all need to be doing our part, and you certainly have done a good piece in writing this book, which sums up a lot of very important information.
Thank you. Yeah, my goal was, as you said, to sum up a lot of information because there's so much information out there and so many kinds of decisions to make that I wanted to boil it down to make it easy to remember and also for people to have kind of a mental template for dealing with so much conflicting new information.
It's so confusing.
Or varying new types of ideas.
It's so confusing. And, you know, I love the internet and there's so much information there, but you have to know what's good and what isn't good, what's real and what isn't real.
Exactly. And you need to be able to tell which website or speaker is simply fronting for big agribusiness.
The title, Food Print, that's kind of clever. Where did that come from, and what are you trying to say with that?
Okay, well, it actually started out as a typo. My first book on food and the environment was called Eating to Save the Earth and came out 10 years ago. And I was just, you know, typing up folders and letters to people, and that kept cropping up. So as people began to talk about their carbon footprint, I thought, well, gee, this makes sense. If we can reduce our food footprint on the earth, it's incredibly important because the agriculture portion of our economy, and by that I mean including packaging, transportation, et cetera, produces something like 20% of greenhouse gases.
Right.
And so anything we can do individually to cut that down is important, and actually even the big corporations are paying attention. I'm just reading the most recent news, which I'm sure you've been on top of as well, that General Mills has found a way to put more Cheerios into their big Cheerio boxes. And they figure that this one change alone will save 1,000 trees a year.
Right, because there's always so much extra space in those cereal boxes.
Right. And, you know, I'm not a big cereal eater, but a lot of people are. And
yeah.
if that one change can save 1,000 trees, just imagine all of the other changes.
There are so many things that we can do just by thinking, and
yes.
most people aren't. Most people are kind of sleepwalking or not focused on what's really important. But absolutely, there are so many ways that we can save little bits here and there, and those little bits do add up. It's just like the little drops that that are necessary to fill a bucket.
I'm remembering a talk that Howard Lyman gave some years ago. Howard Lyman, I'm sure you know, and maybe your listeners need to know, is the author of Mad Cowboy, and in which he tells the story of growing up as a cattle rancher and then having an epiphany and then turning out and becoming an organic vegan activist. And in this talk, he said, you know, we don't have to reach everybody. If we reach enough people, and I don't know if you said 20% or what figure, then the rest will follow.
Absolutely.
So when I get discouraged, I think I remember that and say, you know, we've got to reach the key people, and we are.
Well, you wrote a book 10 years ago about saving the earth, and now you've written this one. What have you seen change in those 10 years?
Oh, first of all, it's wonderful. There are so many... so much more awareness. The organic niche of the food market has been growing hugely every year, and that's because people are buying it. They're willing to pay the price premium, and every bit of news that comes out about GMO and pesticides, it just drives people more and more to awaken. And another thing is that I've seen in the last 10 years is the number of organizations involved.
A lot more.
Do you know Paul Hawkins' group, Wiser Earth? It's a website, wiser.org, and it's a kind of clearinghouse of groups all around the planet that are working for sustainability. And I just checked it out today. If you put in... sustainable food, there are over 5,000 nonprofit organizations working on sustainable food. And if you put in healthy food, there are 900. If you put in organic food in this wiser.org website, you get over 8,000 organizations. So the positive news is that people are getting together, and of course there's your organization. You have a 501c3.
I do, responsibleeateatingandliving.com.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. And that's what it's all about, healthy food.
Yes, your name, I love your name. And I love the acronym. So I'm so happy that you're inviting me to be on the show here.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
Because we're really on the same page.
Yeah, well, I always liked... I like talking to people that I agree with. But you know what? Occasionally, I talk to people that I don't entirely agree with, and I'm kind of on a campaign right now to align with people about what we do agree on.
Yeah.
And many of us, even though we don't agree on some of the details, we do agree on ending factory farming, making food organic, getting most of our food from local sources, ending genetically modified food, and making food accessible and affordable. And I think everybody in the alternative food movement can agree on those issues.
Exactly. Well, you know, as a psychologist, I have some thoughts to offer on how to talk to people that are different from yourself.
Okay.
In fact, I even want to create a course on this for Saybrook, where I teach. But for the moment, let me just mention some thoughts. One, some of these may be pretty obvious that your readers will go, I mean, your listeners will say, yes, yes, I know that one. But first is emphasize the positive. Now, those of us who are deeply engaged in the alternative food movement have got to understand the negative. We have to read all the bad news. But when we're talking to naive people, that is, people who are busy with their lives and have kids to raise or whatever, and we're not blaming them, that they just, they're newbies, right?
That's right.
So we emphasize the positive. So instead of saying, oh, my God, there's pesticides everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We could say, isn't it wonderful that there's so much organic food?
Mm-hmm.
And the second tip I would give is to emphasize options. There are so many choices, and in fact, that was one of the main drivers of my book, The Green Footprint, is to say, whatever your lifestyle, if you want, even if you don't have a lot of money, there is a little bit you can do for organic.
We can always do better.
Right. Even if you eat meat, which I don't,
mm-hmm.
and I would love it if our meat industry gradually fades away, because it's the most damaging aspect of our whole food system.
Absolutely.
But even if you do eat meat, you can do A, B, and C to reduce your meat impact,
mm-hmm.
and slowly make your way towards sustainability. I think a third point is to set an example. You know, whenever I go to potlucks, I take the tastiest vegetarian dish that I can,
mm-hmm.
and you know, invite people to try that out.
Yep, we have to be the best we possibly can.
Yeah.
Just be the best model, and then people want to know what it is you're doing.
Right. And we don't, I don't think we need to be perfect. In fact, I think that probably would backfire, because if we said, well...
Oh, that's my problem.
A
just
little
kidding.
At a time. You know, my 25 years in therapy practice working with people who had eating disorders, they knew what the right thing to do was. They know where they wanted to get. And the perfectionism of, I'm going to lose 10 pounds tomorrow, or some impossible goal, was part of the problem.
Mm.
And I think the last persuasion point I would make is to take questions and criticism as an opportunity to educate. In other words, if somebody says, as you and I always hear, well, where do you get your protein?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, you know, rolling our eyes and saying, oh, my God, I can't believe you don't know that. We say, oh, I'm so glad you asked. Did you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're off on our little stump speech.
Yes. I met someone recently who said he and his wife had been vegan, but they started eating fish because they were low on protein. And it was not, I wasn't in a place where I could really continue a conversation, but afterwards I was thinking, okay, how did he know he was low on protein?
Right.
Did he have a test, or did he just assume because they were feeling fatigued, a little run down, and then you just start to say you need more protein? And most people say that, and they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they've just gotten worn down by all their friends telling them
they're
low on protein,
sure.
You know?
I'm kind of curious because, you know, you have a great background in psychology, and so many people, most of their food issues are related to personal emotional problems.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, right now in the United States, we have about a third of the population, adult population, who are overweight, obese.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can put all of this great information out in front of them, but there's a bigger problem there. And
yes, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, I think we're in the middle of a huge cultural shift.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's easy for me to say because I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and apart from the fact that every third person is a therapist, every fourth person is a healthy food advocate. So we're, you know, and you're in New York where there's lots going on.
Mm-hmm.
So nevertheless, I think the cultural shift is happening. For example, I'm sure you saw this in the news. Disney recently announced, like yesterday, they're not going to put junk food advertising on their television shows, radio, and website.
Wow, that's big.
Mm-hmm. That is huge. Michelle Obama said, man, this is a game changer. So... it really is happening, and I'm just really sad for the children that are obese now, because it's going to be an uphill battle for them to regain their health.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, back to the culture change. the idea that vegetarianism is not a aberration, but it's just a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You can go into most restaurants and find at least one vegetarian option, or the chef will fix something for you. But I don't want to forget your question, the emotional causes of overeating.
Well, because it's so prevalent today. It's
yes.
so prevalent. You know, I talk about the importance of green juicing all the time because for lots of reasons. And then a lot of people I talk to ask me about juicers, and they buy a juicer and they use it for a week, and then it goes up in their cupboard and they don't use it, and then they start putting on weight. And
oh, I have to plead guilty to that one.
But, you know, how do we turn that around?
Oh, well,
I mean, as a psychologist, there's a lot of people that have emotional issues, and as a result, it's affecting their health, and it's affecting all of us.
Right.
It's a big question.
Yes, I know. And, of course, as a retired therapist, I believe in the, you know, the profession of learning about yourself and discovering your inner emotional life. So I think most people could benefit at one time or another from a venture into psychotherapy, even if they don't have an overt symptom. So that's one thing. Culture change in terms of, you know, turning people on to organizations in their local community, because a lot of people eat from loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they can hook up, I mean, it could be anything. It could be a dog rescue organization. It could be a Little League team. Whatever it is that gets them out of the house and connecting with people. You know, the research shows that longevity is partly impacted by how big your social network is.
Right.
Quite apart from any other thing.
Oh, well, it's a really challenging problem, because I, with myself and my nonprofit, I'm always trying to think, you know, how can I help to get people healthier? And basically what we're doing at Responsibility and Living is providing all kinds of information for those who want it. But I'm always looking for some secret angle to help those that are really, really challenged. And I don't know what that is. I think when individuals want to make change and they recognize that there are some issues, I think we all have the capacity to go within and figure mm-hmm. out what our challenges are and decide if we're going to work on them or not. But there are just some that don't want to.
Right. It's like what they say in the 12-step group, you have to want to be there.
Mm-hmm. But then I think it's sort of like a catch-22, where some of the diets that so many people are on today kind of enforce this lethargy and this kind of blasé attitude and not wanting to make change. It's kind of hard to get out of it when you're eating the foods that you're eating that aren't giving you energy and keeping your brain clear.
Exactly. And
it's a challenge.
Excuse me? I'm sorry, say again.
It's very challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that let me just share with you one tidbit from my eating disorders practice.
Mm-hmm.
There is one thought that I can put into one sentence that is the cause, and I'm going to make up a number here, of 80% of the overweight in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's a ridiculously ambitious statement, but I wanted to get your listeners' attention. And here's the thought. Well, it's 10 o'clock, and I've already blown it for today.
Mm-hmm.
I might as well go all out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a black and white thinking, and I've had people tell me, well, all my overeating comes after I think that thought. So one thing that people can do who are seriously challenged is to really not believe that thought, because that just digs you deeper.
Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind. Even if you've made a mistake, don't knock yourself for it. Just pick yourself up and get back to where you want to be.
Right. And the partner strategy to that is, when you do make a good choice, pat yourself on the back.
Mm-hmm.
Because another thing that I heard often, I would compliment somebody. They would tell me a story or something that happened, and I'd say, wow, that's wonderful. And in about one nanosecond, they would say, oh, well, I should have known that 10 years ago. Or, everybody knows this already. What's wrong with me? So the follow-up thought is just as important to challenge and to kind of support your support, as it were.
Yeah, it's, you know, I have not studied the brain. I don't know what goes on there, but my understanding is, you know, a lot of people continue to hear these negative voices and these voices that do not encourage. And it takes a lot of work to re-script that and to have the voices telling you you're doing a good thing and not to beat up on you all the time. That's a lot of work, but it's definitely worthwhile.
Oh, exactly. Thank you for bringing that up. That's the cognitive therapy approach.
Mm-hmm.
And cognitive therapy was invented to give people practical tools. And there are books, and you can practice it yourself. So one book that is a classic is called Feeling Good by David Burns, and he walks you through how to re-script these voices. And, you know, sometimes it takes a lot of work, and sometimes people go, oh, I get it. So I always try to leave room for the possibility that you might have a sudden aha.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, with change, it's like prepare yourself to take 1,000 steps, but also be ready to receive a moment of aha.
We just have a couple of minutes left, so I wanted to just highlight a few things. You have 5 of the most important decisions in your book. Eat clean food, eat lower on the food chain, eat shorter on the food chain, eat wider on the food chain, and nude food.
Right.
Just in a few minutes, what is nude food?
Nude food refers to less packaging.
Mm-hmm. Like eat an apple.
Yeah, or a banana or a walnut. You know, they come in their own packaging. The amount of natural resources wasted in packaging is just breathtaking. Petroleum to make the plastic. I mean, it's, and then we just throw them away after one use. So one thing people could do is support the ban on plastic bags in their community if they want to get politically active, as some people do. So nude food refers to anything that reduces packaging.
Right. It's just something to think about. Pay attention everywhere that you're buying food, because so many foods come wrapped and then wrapped and then wrapped. It's just so overwrapped.
Yes, or in tiny packages.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand that parents of school-age children, it must be incredibly tempting to buy juice in those little boxes.
Right, and it looks like everyone else's, and it's convenient. But there are ways. There are those, you can buy those containers that look about the same size and fill them up with juice from a larger container. There's all kinds of solutions.
Yes, so that would be something else that that people could do about packaging. Or obviously, recycle religiously.
Well, there's a lot of tips, and they're all in your book, The Green Food Print. So it's time to go. Anyway, I was really enjoyed talking to you, and thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. And you have a website, thegreenfoodprint.com.
That's correct.
All one word, thegreenfoodprint.com. Lots of great tips up there. Thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food.
Oh, thank you, Karen. Thank you, and thank all your listeners.
Okay.
Thank you,
all
everybody.
Right.
Okay. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and we're going to take a short break and come right back because I'll be talking with Chef Roberto Martin, the personal chef of Ellen DeGeneres. And while you're waiting, go visit ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com, my nonprofit website with lots of other wonderful information. We'll be right back. Heartless, and you're listening to It's All About Food. I am so excited about what's going on these days with this explosion in vegan cuisine. We're hearing about the vegan diet all over the place, and so many wonderful people are coming on over to the vegan side. And for myself, doing this for over 25 years, it is so wonderful to see all of this happening. And we only benefit. The more people that do it, the more availability vegan products are around in stores and in restaurants. And I find everything just becomes more and more delicious. But some people may think that this vegan thing is a fad. And it's not a fad. In fact, people who refuse animal products for ethical reasons, all animal products, meat and dairy, everything, were referred to as Pythagoreans. This thing started over 2,000 years ago, Pythagoreanism. It's kind of a mouthful. But people have been doing it for a long time. And it wasn't until 1944 that the word vegan was coined. I think it's easier to say and easier to spell. And helped us move into the 20th century with this concept. But people have been doing it a long time. What people have not been doing for a long time is eating the quantities of meat and dairy and refined foods that we've been doing in the last 50 years. So I think in some ways we're kind of getting back to where we belong. And today I've got someone to talk to who's really helping making that happen with some wonderful, delicious recipes. I want to welcome Roberto Martin, who is the author of a new cookbook, Vegan Cooking for Carnivores. And he has been working for Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi. He was not a vegan chef to begin with. He quickly discovered that the flavors that worked in his best non-vegan dishes, the dishes he loved and that were adored by his many celebrity clients, worked in vegan dishes as well. He learned how to make delicious, easy substitutions of animal-based products with plant-based protein to create perfect, familiar, and comforting food that also happens to be easy to make, healthy, and vegan. Roberto Martin attended the Culinary Institute of America, became a private chef, and honed his knowledge of nutrition and health, customizing meals to meet the dietary needs of his celebrity chefs. Now, he cooks exclusively vegan meals for DeGeneres households and appears frequently on the Ellen DeGeneres Show. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm good.
Pythagorean.
You know, we had to come up with a new word because it's impossible to smell and to spell and say.
Yeah, sounds like a mathematical theory, I think.
But the point is, you know, people have been thinking about this and doing this a long time. And I was reading that even the lacto-ovo vegetarian concept, which is more popular today than the vegan diet, that wasn't the, quote, norm thousands of years ago either. People that decided not to eat animal foods didn't eat any.
No, it makes a lot of sense. Sometimes I get like this, hey, can you just do a vegetarian instead? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, dairy is one of the worst things. I'd rather somebody, like, just, you know, eat fish once in a while than, like, eat milk and dairy. The way we get it to our table these days, too.
The first thing I want to talk about is what Portia wrote in the foreword. Because I've been thinking about this concept. Instead of making vegan food, he made food vegan. And this is really an important distinction. When we think about, like these people that say to you, can you make it vegetarian, not vegan, it's sort of some sort of perception that vegan isn't fun, it isn't delicious, and all we need to do is take classic dishes and leave out a few of the bad ingredients, put in some good ones, and voila.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first, just hearing that makes me smile. It's such a sweet thing, you know, to say. And but it is. It was my approach, and it seems like it works for everyone. People are they cling to being a carnivore because they have these memories of childhood and holidays and all these things. And I get that. At first, you know, I'm dedicated myself to food, you know, so I get that. But what I want people to do is to not abandon those flavor combinations and those memories and stuff. Just sort of reinvent them.
Mm-hmm. I think it's fun, actually, whenever I hear about something that somebody misses or something they want to make and they can't imagine it being vegan. I love taking on that challenge. Oh, I can make that.
Yes.
I can do it.
That's exactly the way I feel, too. you know, I don't know that this opportunity came to me early in my career if I would have had the same enthusiasm or the same excitement about it. But I had been doing it for about 10 years. I'd been a professional cook for about 10 years. And it came at just the right time when I felt like maybe I was spinning my wheels a little bit. And, you know, when I took this interview, I didn't even necessarily want the job. I was like, you know, I don't have a passion for vegan food. But once I accepted the challenge, it like completely reinvented my creativity and my desire of trying every single day to like make new stuff. And I think that can happen for the average American as well.
Now, is there a reason why they were looking for a chef and not specifically a vegan chef, Ellen and Portia?
No, that concept hasn't necessarily clicked for them, but they were open to anyone who could fulfill the position. They had encountered on some interviews, like, well, this person's a vegan chef, but also a life coach, or also a yogi, or something, and they're like, I just want some food, you know. they are vegan because they love animals and stuff, but they get that on their own. They don't need, you know, everything else. If they want to do yoga, they can have an instructor come or not, or do it themselves. They just wanted a chef.
Right.
And so that's what my approach is. And I think that other approach kind of has turned off the average carnivore. You know,
eating vegan food as compared to making food vegan.
Yeah. Because what happens is vegans taste something and they like it. They've been vegan for a long time. And what I keep in my mind is I'm trying to feed a guy who just had Carl's Jr. yesterday. Yeah, that's what I always keep in my mind. So mm-hmm. Is this food going to be satisfying for him or her? And that's the litmus test for me.
I lived in the south of France for 4 years, and I was a vegan, and I ate vegan. And what was interesting was all of the chefs, I think, when I would go to a restaurant and tell them what I did eat and what I didn't eat, were kind of amused and then enjoyed the idea of taking on the challenge. The only problem I ever had was in Paris and Lyon. But everywhere else, they really enjoyed the opportunity to do something different, and they often did some really lovely, lovely things.
Sometimes that's the case. I think that for the most part, that's not quite the case yet in restaurants.
Yeah.
And I think that when you are a vegan, and I identify myself as 95% vegan,
mm-hmm.
And I think anytime you go to a regular restaurant that's not a particular vegan restaurant, the odds of you getting some butter or some chicken stock or something in your meal are really high. And,
yep.
And you either need to just accept that or not eat it out, you know. And I don't think that's fair. I don't think it's right, but that's just something you need to sort of put in the back of your mind.
Anytime you eat in a restaurant, it's a leap of faith.
Well, that's true. Yeah, exactly right.
I mean, no matter how many regulations they put in place, you don't know what's going on back there.
You never really do.
You grew up with 14 other siblings.
Yeah.
every mealtime was like a catered event, and that's like, that's incredible. That's a lot of food.
Yeah, yeah, it's funny. When I went to culinary school, a lot of my colleagues were, they come from this like family restaurant background, you know, and I don't. But I had similar stories and memories, which was really funny, because every day we had a service. You know, my mom started cooking at 12 noon. We had these big pots, and my dad, being a real big disciplinarian, none of the kids were allowed to go over other people's homes. But we had an open door policy. My brothers and sisters could bring anyone to our house. So, you know, for like a good 5-6 years, I had brothers in football, my sisters in, they were cheerleaders, and they would just bring, you know, all kinds of people over. And so every night, it was, you know, 20-25 people for dinner, and there was this big, loud excitement, and it was also kind of like a restaurant, too, because it was silent for a while, you know, from like 3 to 4,
mm-hmm.
and then it would get louder and louder and louder and funner, and then it would die down again, and then there would be a cleanup, and it was like, oh my God, not until I worked in a restaurant did I realize, you've been doing this for a while.
No, absolutely, yeah. Okay, so you got your culinary training using all kinds of animal foods,
mm-hmm.
and is this like frustrating at all for you? My partner, who became vegan 6 years ago, comes from a culinary background, and in the beginning he would say that, you know, he learned how to do all of these different things that he doesn't use anymore, but now he's getting kind of clever and thinking about how he can apply them to the gazillion fruits and vegetables that are out there.
You know, I don't know that the best approach would be to not learn how to use animal products, because it's so rich in tradition and theory. And I think that that's what made me a better
mm-hmm.
vegan chef, mm-hmm. was knowing the flavor combinations and the textures and the desire that people are looking for.
You've worked with Tal Ronan. We love Tal Ronan. He is just a creative genius and a no-ego, lovely, lovely person. I'm glad to see that you worked with him. He also has a gorgeous cookbook.
Yes, The Conscientious Chef. And he's one of the coolest guys, too.
Yeah, he's just good. And, okay, I don't want to make a broad generalizations, but when you're in this business of creating food that is relatively cruelty-free, I think it attracts a certain kind of person, and whether you were that kind of person or not to begin with, it just opens a door to who you are and your place in the world and makes you a nicer person.
I couldn't agree more.
You sound like a nice guy.
Thank you. As I compliment myself, could you imagine some snobby, arrogant vegan chef? It doesn't work.
I don't know any.
But you don't know any, okay.
We're all about love.
Exactly. It doesn't work, and it's a really pretty thing. It really is. Something that happened to me, I'll tell my little story here because it was weird. I started working for Ellen and Portia late in January, and the year before, I was at a restaurant with my wife, and it was walking around the venue, and I said, you know, I don't think I'm gonna cook Foie Gras anymore. So it's just question. I don't need that. You know, we don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
And then like a month later, I felt the same way about veal. And I think what it did was it opened up a tiny little door in me. It opened up like a tiny little window that said, "You're still a good chef."
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't work with these types of meats, you
mm-hmm.
know, it's okay to make decisions based on your conscience rather than decadent.
It's more than okay.
Yeah, exactly. And then when I took this job, that's when everything, you know, just like the worm turned for me, as they say. You know what I mean?
And your family, are they eating this way too?
Mostly.
Yeah.
Mostly, you know. My son,
Jackson, he's adorable.
Oh, he is.
And he looks like he's a great ravioli maker.
Oh, God, those pictures turned out so good.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you so much. Yes, they are. And he's quick to tell everybody, I'm dairy-free. And, you know, because he can identify everything else, but he tries to make sure there's no cheese on his stuff. It's so cute.
Now, the thing that's made vegan food, or should I say food that can be made vegan, so much easier and varied and delicious is that we now have access to a staple of prepared products
mm-hmm.
that we didn't have 20, 30 years ago. So you can get your transition meats. I don't even want to call them transition meats anymore, but Gardein is out there, which is a brilliant gluten-based food that can be used in recipes instead of meat. We have vegan mayonnaise. We have vegan butters. There's this long list of condiments and things that are now vegan that make everything so much easier. And you use a lot of them in your cookbook.
I do, especially since my book is really aimed at people who are trying to go vegan for the first time. I really think that what they need is food that looks very similar to mm-hmm. the food they were eating before. And thanks to things like Gardein and Field Roast, they make that possible. So it would be almost silly to do this book without putting Gardein in it because it's just such a killer product. And it's available, you know,
it's a living product, not a killer product.
You're right. That's your point. Exactly. Non-killer product, I guess. Yeah. That's the other great thing is that, you know, I see Gardein at Target. You know, and so that's so awesome because I wanted to make sure that no matter where you live in the country, you would have access to the products that I suggest in the book.
I think I've got a number of things I want to say here.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I like to do is put delicious food in front of people. They don't have to know it's vegan, except most people know that I'm like this nutty, crazy, passionate vegan anyway, so they know that they wouldn't get anything else from me. But if I'm in a group of strangers or whatever and I prepare something and put it in front of them, I don't want them to know it's vegan. They don't have to know. They just have to know it's good and looks good. And I think today people are eating so many prepared foods, ready-to-eat foods, even in restaurants and certainly in fast food, where the food isn't even food. It's so highly processed and so highly manufactured and denatured, and then other synthetic things are kind of added to it, that when you give them something that's made from whole, fresh, minimally processed foods, they can't help but taste the difference. It's crazy good.
Yeah, that's when I think nature takes over on us. If it looks like food that we're supposed to eat, it tends to be more attractive. And what you said is exactly how I approach it, is just making good food, and regardless of whether it's vegan or not, it's okay, this is good food, and people react positively to it. And then if they inquire more and find out it is vegan, then they're like, oh my God, this is great. I had vegan food before. I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my life. So then it opens that little door for them. So the next time that they have the option, they might, I'll try that. And, you know, it just sort of puts the right foot forward.
Do you have any cookbooks that were inspiration to you, either vegan or not vegan?
Well, you know, I didn't want to, it's almost like I didn't want to, like, you know, if you were writing a script, start watching particular movies, because you know you're just going to end up copying them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my fear. I was like, oh my God, I don't want to, like, you know, but I do have, you know, the Nobu Matsuhisa is one of my guys that I love, and
who is
I love
that?
Julie. Nobu. Nobu Matsuhisa. And by the way, you know, speaking of that, I've done some fabulous sashimi meals. Well, really call them sashimi meals, but vegan sashimi meals for Ellen and Porsa with sliced avocado and marinated tofu and all these wonderful things with the colors and the flavors and the appearance that you get from sushi, but that's just a side note. I love Anthony Bourdain, and I love Paul Ronan's book.
Mm-hmm.
I love you know, the China study, where anytime I needed some sort of fact or sort of something to just sort of...
That's loaded with information.
Yeah, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Saffron Four's book.
Oh, I love that book.
Yes.
Yeah, Eating Animals. I recommend that book to so many people just because it's so genuine, and he goes back and forth with his own personal struggle with deciding to not eat animals, and people need to read that, and maybe they'll come to the same conclusion he did, or maybe they won't, but I just appreciated how real it was.
Yeah, and the guy's like super smart.
And
he writes this book that is just so wonderfully approachable. He takes you on his own little journey with him. You know,
yeah.
About that book.
For me, one of the cookbooks that inspired me, this was like centuries ago, was The Joy of Cooking, and I had a paperback version, one of the original editions, and everything was in like super tiny print, but it had every recipe known to man in this book, or so I thought. And this was before vegan cookbooks existed, and I was making food vegan from these recipes, and I don't know what happened to that book. I think it's just dissolved into dust. I used it so much. But now we have so many cookbooks, and it's really, really a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
You use rice paper a lot. Love it.
I've always loved that product. And
I really appreciate that you have the pictures to show step by step. I was making some rolls the other day before I looked in here. And every I don't do it that often, and I forget. And so it takes like 10 rolls before I get in the hang of how to fold them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The pictures were really important to me because just with words, it can't really convey.
Yeah.
Am I doing this right? I think I am, but I'm not really sure. So the pictures just make things click. And I really encourage people to do that because it's a lot of fun, especially if you have some kids that want to help. My son loves it because it feels like gummy bears or, you know, goofy thing. And like you said, you know, the first three might look atrocious, but once you get in the groove, you start rolling them just perfect.
Yeah, they just roll. But you can put so many wonderful things in them. I like them because they're not fried and they're fresh and they just taste great. But speaking of fried, the one recipe in this book that I haven't seen anything like anywhere, and I've read almost every vegan cookbook there is the fried chicken.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
That's genius.
Thank you so much. You know, what happened was that Oprah was coming for dinner,
mm-hmm.
and she had once mentioned to Ellen, you know, she would go vegan, but she just doesn't want to give up fried chicken. And so Ellen said, "You need to make fried chicken." And I'm like, yeah, okay, great. And then, you know, frying up the garden came to mind, and that was simple. But for me, fried chicken was always about skin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's mm-hmm. a South Park that's famous. It's so funny because this little fat kid goes in there and he eats all the skin off the fried chicken and then leaves. It just makes me laugh because it is, you know, the best part. And so I wanted to put some kind of skin on this chicken so that it would really have that flavor and texture combinations that she's used to. And, you know, I've been making these spring rolls for them all the time, and so it was just sort of a natural thing that clicked. And, yeah, I'm so stoked with that. What also happens, incidentally, it wasn't on purpose, but what happens is the spring roll wrappers lock in all the juice mm-hmm. in the sardine, and it's so juicy.
I haven't made it, but I will.
Thanks. The reaction that I'm getting online and on my Facebook friends for the book that has made it has been like, this has been crazy good.
Yeah.
And what I like about the fried chicken and the chicken pot pie and the red beans and rice is that you don't even have to tell your family that we're doing, you know, a meatless day or whatever. You just make it. They like it. It goes into the rotation, and now they're eating less meat.
Yeah, you don't have to. You don't have to tell them. All of this food is so good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, really good. Oprah hasn't gone vegan, so I guess she
hasn't. She loves the food and everything. And
she had Tal working for her for a while. She's had all the opportunities. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not gonna happen.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, we are so glad that Ellen has taken this on and become vegan, because it's so important. We learn so much from celebrities on television and in the movies. We learn so much from them, and many of us want to be like them. And so why shouldn't someone who is a spokesperson for all of us take the right path, do the right thing, help people get healthy, help make this world a better place, do things that are good for the environment? And I love her for that.
I love her for so many reasons. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at her career and what she stands for, she's not very passionate about any other cause or anything else. She doesn't, you know, stand at the pulpit. She doesn't even stand at the pulpit about, you know, gay rights. She sort of watches that and leads by example. But when it comes to animal love of animals and being vegan, that is her passion.
Mm.
And Portia, of course.
Well, I think when someone has the means and they have the opportunity to do the best that they can, why shouldn't they? I don't understand why they wouldn't. And so Ellen and Portia have the opportunity to have a wonderful chef, and you make them wonderful meals, and it sounds like they make some of their own food too, which is great. We don't have to have our own personal chefs to make this food, and you make that point many times in the book, that which recipes are easy, and they are.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, the one thing I think that I have an advantage as opposed to like a restaurant chef is that I kind of feel, well, plus I have a 7-year-old, but I do feel like I'm a little bit more in tune with the average, you know, household that has these challenges of, you know, getting kids from school to karate or baseball or whatever they do, and then busting out dinner. And so I took that into heart when doing the book, because, you know, people need it. They need it now. They need it easy. I'm competing with all of the ready-made ads for you that people have on their go-to list. And so I had to make these recipes doable. You know, the fried chicken is a little bit more effort. That may be a Friday night or a Saturday night dinner, but there's lots of meat. The red beans and rice you can make so fast.
Well, you know, regular fried chicken isn't quick either, unless you do the shake and bake variety.
No, but it's still not all that fast.
You have to bread it, and that's time consuming.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But what I'm looking at is, you know, are they buying, you know, some sort of frozen thing and putting it in
sure.
And then you're done.
Probably.
You know? Which what I think a lot of people reach for. And I'm also a little student of people's shopping carts, because I'm in the regular supermarket all the time, and I'm just, I just stare at what people are buying, and I'm like, oh, sweetie.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, don't.
No.
No, you want to take care of yourself and your family. What is that in there?
I just want to grab people by the hand. Give me 20 minutes here. We're going to help you out here.
Well, you're going to need to team up with Tal and Gardein and package this fried chicken thing.
You know, you're not the first person to say that.
Yeah.
I actually have a conversation going with Ayas as well right now. He's the owner of Gardein, and he's a super sweet man. And, I'm hoping to do that for people so that they can pop that healthy food in the oven and feed their family some meat-free meal.
Well, Roberto, thank you so much for talking to me today and taking a moment to be on It's All About Food. How do you pronounce your last name? Is it Martin or Martin?
Well, you know what? It really is Martin, but it's spelled the same way, and
yes.
I don't want to get into that.
I like to say names the way they're supposed to be said. Roberto, Martin, muchas gracias.
Un placer. Take care. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much. And have a very delicious week, everyone. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food, and please check out my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. You get more delicious recipes there. And definitely pick up this book, Vegan Cooking for Carnivores. It's beautiful. The recipes are satisfying and perfect. Have a great day.